If you want this podcast free of ads, follow us now on patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
I'm just giggling here with John. We're talking about the great Morrissey track, Roy's Keane.
Go on!
Isn't it great?
It is great.
It's great. It's,
I'm just not a fan of Morrissey, but that's a good track.
Yeah, it is a good track. Morrissey and Keane together, you have to be a fan of Morrissey.
No.
You have to be.
He's a miserable git.
Well, he's also a Man U supporter.
Yeah.
That's not welcome around here. But the Roy's Keane is just great. I actually wonder, are there any other great tunes about footballers?
Wasn't there a, what was that Chelsea player, Peter?
Osgood.
Peter Osgood.
Oh, yeah. He scored against Leeds in the 1970s.
Oh, he was my brother's hero.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was a demon in our house. His name was Muck. Anyway, what's the crack, my man?
It's all good. It's all good. Listen, there's loads of stuff happening this week.
I know. We're blessed. We're blessed. And you know who's back? Do you know who's back?
Tarquin.
Tarquin's back. He's in the...
Oh, here he comes.
No mandatory quarantine for Tarquin. And he's now, Tarquin is going to broker the deal between KBC and Bank of Ireland to totally stitch up the Irish banking market.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to happen.
Explain this to me. What's happening?
Okay, so what is happening is the calcification of the Irish banking market is now complete. Okay.
Right.
That's what's happening. There will be two banks in effect, Bank of Ireland and AIB. AIB took over, as we know, Ulster Bank not that long ago in mm-hmm. the West Lower. Remember, there was Tarquin, of course, he's actually up the bar now.
Yeah.
Tarquin gets a few pints.
Few pints there.
Yeah, and there's Mick, Pat, Anton.
And there's Barry.
Barry from PTSB.
Yeah.
Which obviously sounds like some sort of trauma experience.
Did you need some cream for?
Yeah, exactly, right? And the lads are orchestrating the deal, right? And now, of course, we have Bank of Ireland has come in and it's going to buy KBC. Now, what that means is that there will be no competition in the Irish banking market at all. It will be a duopoly. Now, what it means for punters is that the rate of interest that is going to be charged in Ireland, the mortgage rate, which is already the highest in Europe,
yeah.
will go yet higher. That's the first thing.
Oh, man.
The second thing is Ireland will have gone from a situation where we were coming down with banks before 2008. Too many banks lending too much money to too many people. Now we will have too few banks, probably not lending enough. So all economies need a vibrant banking system.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That is the essential lubricant of the economy because the banking system is what pushes money around. It's like the heart of the system.
Of course, yeah.
And if your banking system is calcified, it's almost like the hardening of the arteries, right? So it doesn't matter how
we
much money.
We need some statins in the banking system.
We need some statins and high blood pressure and all our carry on. But you know what we need, John? So what happens is it doesn't matter how much money the ECB prints. So imagine the ECB printing like a massive big hose of money.
Right? Well, they did.
Yeah, but the problem is every country, so there's a big hose coming out from the ECB of money, right? And every country has their own little hoses, right?
Right.
But our hose is just a trickle.
Yeah.
Right? And so
there's a kink in the pipe.
There's a kink in the pipe, and it's the banking system here is going to end up not being willing or able to lend out. So what they're going to do is they will charge higher interest rates. So, and again, what it is, John, this is another disaster for millennials, because millennials need finance in order to finance mainly their house purchasing. And it's going to just cause that finance to be much, much less available to them.
Well, the question then surely is, number one, what's Pascal and the government doing? And what's the central bank doing?
This is the whole thing. So let's look at the detail, right? KBC is a bank that had loads and loads of loans and not enough deposits here, right? It had about 10 billion of loans and about 5 billion of deposits. So it was being financed by the head office in Belgium. That's the first thing, right? Bank of Ireland needed to respond to AIB because AIB just bought Ulster, right? So Bank of Ireland said, we got to go do something, right? And then, of course, what happens is the central bank now has presided over, like, the job of the central bank, okay? There are many jobs of the central bank, but one of the main jobs is to make sure that we have a competitive banking system.
Yeah.
So the question must be asked, what is the central bank doing? What is their strategy to make Irish banking competitive? What are they going to, are they even asking themselves that in the last 2 months, two major banks pulled out of the country?
Yeah.
Ulster Bank and KBC, they've left.
Yeah.
Why? If Irish interest rates are high, it means this place is more profitable. So why are banks leaving? And what's the central bank going to do about it? Because the central bank has said nothing at all. It says nothing about monetary policy, even though it's should implement monetary policy here. It says nothing about the banking system. It says nothing about regulation. And then, back to our friend Davies, it says nothing to see here.
Yeah.
When we know a fraud was committed.
Yeah.
The central bank said nothing to see. And as Bill Black said, it's not their job to say nothing to see here. That's the prosecutor's job.
Yeah.
It's not the central bank's job. Central bank is to say, this happened. Then you give that to the DPP and the DPP say, okay, it is or it is not a crime. So here we have the central bank saying, we saw this happening. We know it's fraud, but we've decided it's not a crime.
This is your man Magaluf.
Yeah.
Magaluf. I call him Magaluf.
Have you ever been to Magaluf?
No, but my daughter has. You know, on the...
the Leaving Cert
trip. The Leaving Cert trip. She hated it, actually.
Really?
Yeah,
no, it sounds very dodgy.
Yeah.
Sounds dodgy. What was our version of Magaluf? Cortan.
It was.
Yeah. It was. Prince Bay.
Kilmuckridge.
God, I'm traumatised by Kilmuckridge. 1980s Kilmuckridge.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Anyway,
get off that.
My head is a Marley. So what we have is a central bank which is not doing its job. And in this regard, I feel sorry for Pascal Donoghue because he's the Minister of Finance, right? But his job is not to actually look after the banking system, but it's to face down the central bank. They're doing nothing.
Yeah.
What it means for people is that there will be less choice in banking. Now, the other thing we could look at, John, is that long term, it's quite clear that banks, as presently constituted, do not have a future. If you mentioned your kids.
How do you mean?
You mentioned your kids. My kids just use Revolut. They
don't use
banks. They don't use banks, right? And also, what is going to happen is the providers of loans, I think, will be in the future very different to the providers of deposits. So the safe deposit, right, which is what banks use as a function, on one side of the balance sheet, and the loans, which are their asset on the other side, I think will separate eventually. And what you will get is you will get engineers, not bankers, providing loans based on algorithms and based on data about your own credit worthiness and the credit worthiness of the business, right? And then what you'll get is a very dull business, which is basically, where do you put your money? Where do you keep your deposits? And that is what the future is all about, I think. And data is changing that. Technology is changing that. But right now, what I fear is that Ireland will end up with an external part of the economy, right? The multinationals, small businesses, trading, exporting, etc., right?
Yeah.
Being hyper-competitive and being able to play a role in the real world.
Mm.
But a domestic economy. And by that, I mean your public sector, your banking sector, which is now public sector, right?
Yeah.
Your housing market, this sort of areas, our general internal market here, being characterized by insiders who will do anything in the next 10 years to defend their patch. and the difference between the external side of the economy, the trading side, and the non-traded side is going to get bigger and bigger. And that, I believe, could ultimately be really detrimental for the economy. And that's why this is so crucial. It's a funny thing is, when you look at economics, John, it's like any story, you can pick moments where things went wrong.
Yeah.
You know, you say, that's the moment.
That was the key bit, yeah.
And when I look at this consolidation, what I would prefer to call it calcification.
Yeah.
Which is what happens to old lads like us when our bones, right, get all sore, right? When I prefer, it's the calcification of the banking sector and the splendid insiderdom of the West Lower, where they're stitching up the banking system. Nobody in the Irish banking system wants foreign competition, because foreign competition will bring down interest rates and it will play into the hands of the millennials who need an efficient banking system. What we have, banking for the middle-aged, voting for middle-aged parties, voting for a middle-aged government, and stitching up the economy in their interests.
But isn't that kind of that kind of strikes me as a bit of a risky strategy, long-term-wise.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the last election showed us the shift and where the shift is happening. Millennials are shifting towards the likes of Sinn Féin.
No, they've shifted. They've gone.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at who votes for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, it's not only the over 40s, it's increasingly the over 55s.
Yeah.
Right? That's where their power is.
Mm.
It's interesting to look at economics and politics through the prism of demography. Now, you would think that the future of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael is the youth, because the future of any party is the youth, right? The future of anything, any product.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah,
if you're not selling to young people, if you're not getting your message across to young people, and they're not reacting to you, then you've lost the game.
Yeah.
But what I see all the time now is political parties who are in power in Ireland seem to me to be doubling down on their own constituency. So all these things. So for example, like this banking calcification is going to profoundly penalise younger people who are looking for financial options.
Yeah, that are already under pressure. Anyway.
And as we think, I mean, by the way, I was looking at the housing market again this week.
Mm.
This buyer's strike is by far and away the only idea. You've got to get out of this. I mean, there's dross being sold.
Yeah.
There's dross. Like, the quality is appalling.
Yeah.
And we know that the quality is going to get better when the construction industry goes back. And we know that when the market gets back, the quality gets better. I mean, you would want to be miles away from this market, you know, on the buyer strike. But what is interesting is the fact that at every juncture, this government seems to support the middle-aged and older. And that would appear to me to be sort of a clinging on to power strategy, which has no future. Because if you lose the youth, you're gone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
that is one of my favourite national anthems.
Well, it's coming up to the 9th of May. 9th of May is Victory Day for the Russians in the Second World War. This is when they parade all the old veterans in Red Square.
Red Square with all the guys up there and Khrushchev and those brilliant pictures.
Kremlinology. Who's next? So you've got the May Day, of course, is the Soviet for the workers. The 9th of May is the Victory in Europe Day for the
Russian Army. Those shots because they're always so atmospheric.
Yeah.
But come here.
Do you know that they got a big machine that used to blow clouds away?
What? Really?
I love this, isn't it? Russians. Yeah.
Like a big fan?
Like a big fan. So there'd be always blue skies on May Day.
No way.
I swear to Jesus.
I know.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah, go for it.
But, okay.
Because, you know, I spent loads of time
there. Yeah, you did. You spent quite a bit of time.
I've been talking about that in a while.
How's your Russian these days?
That's not good. Plocha. It means shite.
That's all you need. But come here to me. This week, again, you know, we were talking there about clinging on to power.
In Ireland,
Ireland.
Yes, yes.
But the same kind of thing is going on in Russia. Now, I've been watching the Russian troops, two armies.
You're like the Skibbereen Eagle, John. Do you remember that? The Skibbereen Eagle, which was a newspaper in Skibbereen. And it warned the Russian Tsar that, Tsar, be aware, the Skibbereen Eagle has its eye on you. It was during one of these Russian crises.
Really?
Yeah. It's like, now, and the Tsar was going and said, oh, man. The Skibbereen Eagle has
the Skibbereen are on to us. That's another one I'm going to have to look up. But so they'd be building up troops on the Ukrainian border.
Oh, yeah.
What's going on?
And Biden has slapped sanctions on them.
Exactly.
So the relationship between America and Russia is deteriorating very, very rapidly. And, you know, years ago when I went to Russia, right? So I went to Russia in 1990 to learn Russian years and years ago. And I arrived in this small village called Novi Ruza. So there's Novi Ruza and Stary Ruza. Novi means new and Stary means old. Okay.
It's pretty simple.
Pretty simple, right? And I was in Stary Ruza, which was old. So it was a really sort of rickety sort of place, right? And there were all these babushkas, right? And they'd be cleaning, they'd be kind of like Soviet ones, cleaning the streets or whatever.
Sorry, what is a babushka?
A babushka is a grandmother in Russia.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay. Because so, when you say that, I just think of Kate Bush.
Well, there you go. You think of Kate Bush all the time, John, as far as I'm concerned. But so a babushka is a matryoshka as a mother and a babushka is a granny, right?
Right.
And
I'm learning a lot today.
And when I arrived, in this place. And again, the other weird thing is Russians swap H's for G's, right?
Right.
So what we say in H, they have a G instead, right?
Okay.
It's the way it sounds. So they all these.
So me goal.
Yeah. Where did me goal? It's all these almonds. I would be walking on the street. And the and Ulitsa is a street.
Right.
Okay, so I'd be walking on the Ulitsa, and all these almonds would refer to me, Strasvitya, which is how are you, Gitler.
Right.
And I kept looking, what? They were calling me Gitler, Hitler. Because the last Westerners that these women had ever seen was Hitler's army running away in 1942, because it was 50 miles to the west of Moscow, right?
Right.
And of course, the Germans laid siege to Moscow.
Yeah.
And then
when
the Russians turned the whole thing around, the Germans panicked. And there was a really disorderly retreat. And apparently Hitler's army, for those old ones, were full of red-haired blokes.
What was the red hair?
They were German kids. And as far as the Russians were, they had red hair.
Right.
Which is quite popular in Germany. And so I arrive in 40 years later. They haven't seen a Westerner since then. And as far as they were concerned, I was Hitler. I was a Nazi. This place is really full of Russian history, right?
Yeah.
So it's right beside a place called Borodino. Borodino is where in 1812 Napoleon got his arse whipped, right?
Oh,
so you can imagine
the
Grand Army, this big Republican army, and they get as far as Borodino, just to the west of Moscow, and the Russians outfox them, and then suddenly they have to retreat. So it's amazing. It's full of military history, this neck of the woods. But when you live amongst the Russians, and when you live with Russian families, and when you talk to them, and when you begin to try and understand them, you realize that their relationship with the West is really bizarre. On the one hand, Russians will tell you, look, we were sold in the Cold War that the Russians were always the aggressor. That was the general thing. And they will say, well, hold on a second.
Yeah.
You guys invaded us twice, Napoleon and Hitler. You Western Europeans, we never invaded you. We created a buffer zone. This is what they'd say to you on the Warsaw Pact, simply to protect us against you guys,
yeah,
who every 100 years decide to have a pop at us, right?
Yes, fair point.
It is a fair point, right? And of course, they feel very, very proud of the fact that the West has never, ever won.
Yeah, they've pushed them back every time.
Yeah, they pushed them back. And so much so that the Russians sometimes can't understand why the West ever invaded. There's a great piece, I tell you, in a book, Anthony Beaver, who is an English historian, has an amazing book called Berlin. And it's about the battle for Berlin in 1945. But one of the extraordinary little revelations was the Russian troops, the Red Army, when they came into Germany, right? And they saw all these beautiful villages and these gorgeous houses and these tree-lined. Because if you go into Prussia, what was Prussia, it's unbelievably beautiful, right? And the Russians were looking at this and they said, hold on, these Germans are really rich. What were they doing in Russia? The Russians couldn't understand why you would invade them because they were so poor.
Yeah.
And the Germans are so rich.
Yeah,
so in their heads is a totally different worldview of us, right? And now, and you know all the stuff about Peter the Great going to, we talked about it before.
Yeah.
But so the Russians have always wanted to go to the West to learn. Always. So when Peter the Great went, you know, did I tell you about Peter the Great? He was 6'8", John. At a time when the average European was 5'5". Right? Think of it. He was a monster, right? And he had a facial tick, right? And he was into all sorts of mad stuff. He loved cutting up bodies.
What?
He was totally into biology. He was totally into how the body works. Like, he was a really unusual guy. Really, really unusual.
Yeah.
A monster. A monster of a man. Like a real crazy. Like a
and was he thing. Was he kind of seen as that? How was he treated?
He was a complete monster. I mean,
and they saw him as
a total alcoholic. He used to get gargled all the time. But he was what they call, he was autodidactic. He was self-taught. He's very clever.
Right.
And what he...
Autodidactic. That's a great word.
That's a good word, isn't it?
Yeah. Go on.
The shite that we come out in this podcast. But I tell you, in about 1878, maybe 1880, a fella comes back to Moscow with a sextant. You know those things for navigation?
Yeah.
And Peter the Great was obsessed with this. But if you think where Moscow is, right? Moscow's hundreds of miles from the sea. So the Russians had no navy. Right?
They
had no idea what this whole thing. And he was obsessed with technology, and he became obsessed with this. And he asked some of the court, does anyone understand how this thing works? And they said, there was a German ghetto in Moscow. So the way the Russians used to trade with the West is they'd bring merchants in and they'd allow you live in Moscow, but you couldn't trade with them. You couldn't talk to Russians. So there was a German ghetto, and in the German ghetto lived Swedes, Dutch, and Germans, right?
What were they doing there?
They were selling stuff.
Right.
They were selling. So they'd be like agents. Like,
right, okay, yeah.
Be like kind of Dubai now. You know, even all these, like expats, right? Mm. But Peter the Great loved the German ghetto because he could go and get rat arse there, right? With the Germans, right? And drink. And somebody said to him, look, there's a Dutch man there understands how to use this machine. And he became obsessed with Holland and became obsessed with the Navy.
And that's when he went to Amsterdam.
That's when he went to Amsterdam.
Right,
so
gotcha.
He said, what is this place, Holland? And they said, this is the richest place in the world. And he said, that's why he went to Amsterdam. You should imagine when he arrived in Amsterdam, this monster arrives, right? And think about it. This is the man who owned 1/6 of the entire world's landmass. He owned it himself. Because the Romanovs owned it. They owned everything, right? And he worked as a carpenter. He worked as a carpenter in Amsterdam, but went back and built St. Petersburg based on Amsterdam.
Yeah.
So they've always wanted to go to the West. They've always had this weird view of the West. And right now, with Biden turning the screw a little bit on them, this will impact psychologically on Russians because they want to be part of our world. Even though when you talk to them, they're very, very proud. And if you look at, if you look at Pushkin and all the great Russians, there's always a battle in Russia between what they call the soul of Russia, which is the Slavic homeland.
Yeah.
Russia as the motherland of the Slavs. And then this always Occidental sort of drag towards the West, that we should be more Western. And at the heart of all Russians, when you talk to them, is this conflict. Are we Eastern, Orthodox Slavic, or are we European Western? And that's what, you know, we look at all their history is based on this conflict.
My contact with Russians and Ukrainians was in the BBC World Service.
Did you work there?
Yes, I did. Every time. So I worked in the Eurasia section, which included both Russia and Ukraine. But in 2004, there was an election, a Ukrainian election. And when you did the breakfast show, Ukrainian breakfast show, which is 5 a.m. to 6, whatever, every morning they would have another candidate, you know, quiz them or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
so we're doing the show. and then we throw over to the Kiev bureau.
Yeah.
And Alexander would have whoever in. And he started interviewing this guy. I can't remember his name. And Alexander says, so tell us about what you're going to do with the health system or whatever it was. And he started answering in Russian. And Alexander said, hang on a second. Ukrainian election, Ukrainian show. Would you mind speaking Ukrainian? And he goes, listen, when I'm elected, I'll speak Ukrainian during office hours only.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And of course, he didn't win. But of course, a month later, when the elections happened, it was followed very quickly by the Orange Revolution.
Yeah.
And the whole place went up in flames. Followed a few years later by Crimea. And
or as the Russians say, Nasha Krim.
Nah, there
our
you go.
Crimea.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, but it's funny you talk about Crimea because, so Peter the Great starts the expansion of Russia.
Yeah.
This is where we start our discussion, right? He starts the expansion. Catherine the Great comes after Peter the Great. She was actually a German princess, right? She wasn't a Romanov at all because Germany at the time.
That was his missus.
No. It was his nephew's missus, right?
Okay, right.
Germany at the time was like a stud farm for posh people, right? It was. That's the way you went to find a princess bride and all these little German. That's what it was. So if you look at all these crazy families, like the English royal family, it was like a stud farm for posh people, right? Yeah. They go and find, right? Okay. So Catherine the Great comes in, but she's German. She's got a totally different worldview. And she and her lover, Gregory Potemkin, expand Russia.
Mm.
And they expanded all over the world. So you end up with this crazy situation where Russia now is totally incongruous. There's 140 million Russians. They own 1/8 of the world's landmass. 110 million of those Russians live in European Russia, basically the Russia that we know.
Yeah.
So if you look at the map, about 1/10 of the world is occupied by 30 million Russians, right? Or maybe 1/11 of the world.
Right.
And this is what the play is. This is what's going on in Russia right now.
Explain this one now.
So Putin's gang are kleptocrats, right? They would make the West lower blush in terms, right? They are stitching up the whole thing. And we're talking tens, hundreds of billions of euros they've robbed, right?
Yeah.
And they've run out of road. They've run out of road.
Okay.
There's two or three phases in the Putin years. We don't need to go into it, but basically the first 10 years he was seen as the man to do business with.
Yeah.
And he was dealing with oligarchs internally, dealing with the West externally. We brought him into the G8, it was G8 plus Russia. And it was a sort of a warm, fuzzy feeling.
Mm.
Then after 2008, then he goes for Khodorkovsky, the big Yukos guy who was an oligarch.
Yeah.
And that was the test case. Remember I said, there's a moment you think, okay, that's when they changed.
Right?
Because basically Putin is KGB.
Yeah.
And the KGB guys around Putin are the most cynical people in the world. They're trained to be cynics, okay? And then after the 2008 crash, you get a completely different Putin. You get a Putin who can't do business with the West. You get a Putin that the West has falls out with. And you get all those various different
iterations. Is that because he kind of saw a kink in the armor of the West?
Yeah, he understood that the West is really cynical, that the West can be bought.
Yeah.
The Russians understood.
But it was also weak because of the crash.
It was weak because of the crash, but they also understood that you can, that the West has great platitudes and says lovely things, but ultimately it doesn't really act. Mm. And the great example of that is how the Russians managed to elbow out the Americans in Syria by being able and willing to lose troops. So the Russians saw the West as actually being a cynical front that doesn't really have any balls, has principles, but talks about human rights, won't do anything about it, right? So then suddenly if you're a cynic and you're trained by the KGB, you realize this is open season. Mm. So they've had an open season to rob the country for the last 10 years. But now they're running out of road. Why? Because the Russian economy isn't delivering for the Russian people as it should have done. Oil prices spiked up years ago and that was their currency.
Yeah.
Now also oil prices are still high, but they're not spiking up. So there's no extra juice.
Yeah.
And they've robbed so much of it. So they're actually stuck now. And of course, the most recent thing that really freaked them out is Navalny. Right? Navalny, they missed, Putin and his guys missed the youth revolution. That was the Navalny revolution this year. They missed it completely.
Yeah.
So Russia's divided between the young and the old. The old support Putin, let's say the over 50s, and the young can't stand him.
Demographically wise, what is the split, do you reckon?
Well, it's like in most countries. The problem with Russia was that after the end of the Soviet Union, Russians stopped having babies. And in fact, all East Europeans stopped having babies. And it's a very, very interesting demographic reaction to trauma. So what you find, people in the West have babies in countries that they feel are secure.
People don't have
babies in countries. It's an extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
And the Russians have stopped having kids. But still, of course, there's a massive, massive youth population. But amazingly, 53% of Russian graduates want to emigrate. 53%.
Wow.
And probably the most wasteful thing a country can ever do is allow its young people emigrate.
We've
talked about this before.
Yeah, absolutely.
It costs about $1 million to educate a person in the West from the very first day they go into school to the day they end, let's say, in graduate college, if you do it all the way through, right? So if you are allowing people to emigrate, it's the most wasteful thing you can do because you're actually investing in people and then they go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And the Russians have been emigrating in huge numbers since the fall of the Berlin Wall.
The Berlin Wall was like the floodgates just opened then.
Yeah, the floodgates just opened. And if you go to Brighton Beach in the States, it's just all Russian, all Russian.
Yeah.
You know, you see but to come back, so here's the play for Putin, right? Is that Putin understands that the Americans are now going into a proper Cold War with the Chinese.
Yeah.
That China is the enemy.
Yeah.
Putin also needs forgiveness from the West for having robbed his own country. So like a sort of spoiled child, what Putin needs, he needs the West to get to the table, the summit that Joe Biden's talking about.
Yeah.
So how does he do this? He needs to get noticed. How does he do this? He rattles sabers in Ukraine. So he makes trouble in Ukraine in order to get to the table.
So create a problem and then solve the problem.
Create a problem, but then propose the following. So let's go back to the demography, right?
Mm.
Right? Look at Siberia. Siberia is where all the minerals are.
Yeah.
There's 30 million people in what looks like, I don't know the maths, it's maybe a tenth, it's maybe a twelfth of the world's landmass, right? The only people who are repopulating Siberia are Chinese immigrants. So the Chinese strategy, the Chinese strategy is to blindside the Russians and the West in Siberia. This is the long-term play.
Yeah.
And of course, therefore, the Russian strategy is, and the Putin strategy. So imagine Putin's like a cornered regime. They've nowhere to go.
Yeah.
They've got a youth rebellion coming up. They know if this youth rebellion wins, they will all be put in prison. They will all be put in prison, right?
Yeah.
For wholesale kleptocracy, right?
Yeah.
So what they're doing now, they're doubling down on spending on the military and the police in Russia, but they also need an exit strategy. And the exit strategy they are going to play is they need the West to kind of bring them back into the fold, to go back to that period in 2005, 2006, when they were in the G7, West brought them back in. But what can they sell the West to do that? What they can sell the West is an alliance against China in Siberia. Because what America is terrified of is the Chinese incursion into Siberia. Because again, think about it. We go back to Peter the Great, right?
Mm.
Russia is an incongruous concept. It's so big.
Yeah.
It's got 14 time zones.
Yeah,
it's so big. So Vladivostok is beside Japan.
Yes, yeah.
Right? It's beside Japan. And the territory that is up for grabs is Siberia, because there's only 30 million people living there.
So, but you're saying that there's a load of Chinese immigrants moving into Siberia and Eastern Russia.
It's called Chinese crawl. The Russians call it Chinese crawl.
How are they moving in?
They're starting to set up little trading outposts and they're repopulating the towns on the Chinese border beside Russia. And that's freaking the Russians out.
Right. Okay.
Because ultimately the Russians cannot maintain this empire. That's the problem.
See, it's interesting because I would have always thought that the China and Russia relations were pretty solid and they're in each other's pockets.
China and Russia, obviously, in the Soviet period, didn't like each other for a while, then they liked each other, etc. As long as the common enemy was America, they were together. But now, what the Russians...
It's still the same enemy, though, America
and
the West.
The Russians now understand that maybe the enemy is China because Putin needs to be forgiven. Putin and his gang are trying to figure out how do we stay in power for the next 20 years.
Right.
We've got this revolution going on around Navalny. We've lost the youth here, right? We've robbed the country, but we have nuclear power, loads of it. And we have this card to play, which is an alliance, a tacit alliance with the West against China in Siberia.
Right.
And this is the background noise to what Putin is doing in Ukraine. That's only a sideshow. It's actually to get the West back to the table. And Biden has already bitten.
Yeah.
Because he's already said we're going to have a summit with the Russians in the next couple of months.
This actually makes a huge amount of sense in the way Russia's relationship with Trump, because they could play Trump easy enough, even though, you know,
water sports and things like that he was involved in some hotel room.
But they had him, and they could easily play him. And
well, he was a busy fool. He was a useful fool for the Russians, right? But now they understand that the Americans are trying to reconstitute the world into an us and them. Right? If you look at everything Biden's doing, but Biden has already called Putin a killer. Joe Biden, the American president, described the Russian president as a killer. So Putin has nowhere to go. So Putin's trapped. He's cornered, right? And what card can he play? The only card he can play is some sort of proximity to the West and reimagine the relationship with the West as one of mutual interest against China. And therefore, Siberia is the new theater for the Russians and the Americans against the Chinese.
Right.
Because Russia, again, is geographically incongruous, right? It's an incongruous empire. And that empire was started by our good friend Peter the Great and Catherine the Great. And in the old days, Russia's whole existence was dominated by a hatred of the Ottoman Turks. That's all Russia's move to the south.
Okay, oh, yeah. Okay.
Was against the Ottoman Turks.
Yeah.
And the legacy of that is the Caucasus. So the Caucasus is that region of Chechnya and all that part of the Dagestan, Chechnya, all the place.
Yeah.
So basically you have Russia, Iran, and Turkey involved in an economic, political, and religious struggle. 15% of Russians. Russia's a multi-ethnic state. 15% of Russians are Muslims.
Well, 15. It's so bloody big that it's bound to be.
Yeah, but the Muslim population is by far and away the fastest rising. Right?
So right, okay.
All southern Russia is Muslim, right? All that Caucasus area.
Yeah.
And so what you see, therefore, is Putin is blindsided down in the Caucasus because he has to keep his eye there, right? He has this problem with Crimea. By the way, it was Potemkin who was Catherine the Great's lover. And they really were in love. If you read about them, they had a really, really nice love affair. Yeah,
right,
She really loved him. And they wrote all these letters together and they were really cute together. I was reading a book on the Romanovs by a fella called Sebag Montefiore. And it's lovely. The love letters of Catherine the Great to Potemkin are they're really gorgeous, right?
Yeah.
And he actually calls, you know the city Sevastopol?
Yeah.
That means August. Seva is August, right?
Right.
So it means August city. And apparently that's what the month their affair was consummated.
Ooh.
Isn't that lovely?
Wow.
Imagine naming a city. Anyway, there you go, right? But that's the Crimea thing. So the Russians took over Crimea in like 1780 or something. They've been there a long, long time.
Mm.
But so think about it. All Putin's operations in, for example, Syria, right, are all nothing to do with Syria and the Middle East, even though the Russians have elbowed out the Americans there.
Yeah.
It's to do with this theater of operation in the Caucasus, right? So what they want to do is they want to unbalance Turkey, right? Because Turkey is their big enemy in the Caucasus.
Right.
And of course, Turkey is Islamic. It's a Muslim country, right? So that's one problem for Putin.
Yeah. That's a big problem because...
Massive problem.
Because he's bolstering his power as well.
And
Erdogan.
And the Chechens have Putin by the balls because they are the incendiary crowd down there. So... he's got the problem in the Caucasus. He's got the Crimea, which is very popular in Russia. They call it Nasha Krim, our Crimea, right? Yeah. He needs to keep the West on its toes in Ukraine, worried, anxious, right? Underneath it, he has robbed the country and he knows this and they know it.
Mm.
Navalny blindsided him completely because Navalny was a youth revolution that the establishment didn't see at all, didn't see it coming at all, which is why they will probably let Navalny die in prison because they're so cynical, right?
And that'll be the spark.
They're so cynical.
Mm.
And before all this happens, because we're talking about, that's what we're talking about, is the potential implosion of Russia, right? So before all this happens, they have to play one card to get out of jail. And the card they're going to play is the anti-Chinese card. because they know that the Americans have completely shifted on China. As we were talking about Taiwan the other day, right?
Yeah.
The Americans have gone into a much more aggressive, and the Americans have now realized that's the Cold War. It's between China and America. And of course, Biden is old school American State Department, right? And the American state, whereas Trump was just this crazy on his tot, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but Biden's listening to all CIA and all these people, right? Mm. So they've understood this. So why now? Why is Putin doing everything now? Because he needs to get the attention to get to the table.
Yeah.
And in order to get to the table, he has to have something to sell the Americans, right?
Yeah.
And what he's going to sell them is an alliance against China. And the weakest, you know, this expression, the chain is only as strong as the weakest link.
Yeah.
And the weakest link is Siberia, because there's not enough Russians there to defend it.
That's really interesting.
And right down beside them, they have 1.5 billion Chinese people. 1.5 billion versus 30 million Russians.
Yeah.
And that's where all the goodies are. That's where all the ore, that's where all the... And again, you forget that Russia is a nuclear power. That's the big wild card.
Right.
Is that either the West supports Putin, or Putin, the end of Putin is the end of Russia, that it disintegrates into various different...
Well, it could be a big land grab.
It could be a massive land grab. Yeah, right. So think about it. And all these republics in Russia have nuclear power. They're armed, they have nuclear warheads,
yeah.
They have chemical wars, they have everything. Like it's a cesspit of armaments. Okay,
one question for you then as well is that the other card that they may play, though, is gas supply to Germany and to Europe.
They're already playing that. And they will continue to do that.
Yeah.
And again, they know that they have... I mean, basically, Russia keeps European lights on in the winter.
Yeah.
And they also know, and of course, what the Russians have done is the Gerhard Schroeder, the last Chancellor of Germany, he's on the board of Gazprom. So what the Russians understand is that...
Is he?
Yes! And all loads of English lords are on the board of all these Russians. The Russians understand Western vanity.
Yeah.
You know this thing, compromat? This is the Russian idea of diplomacy. It's how do I compromise you?
Yeah.
Right? This is what the Russians have always used, right? So how I compromise you is I bring you into the tent, right? So I give you board positions and I give you money and I give you this and that. And I support,
and give you hookers that I they gave you, to Trump.
All that stuff. But I compromise you. And then, so this is the Russians understand that the West is cynical, right? So their cynicism and our cynicism are met. And they understand that the West can be bought. That's what Putin really figured out.
Yeah.
You can buy these people off. But now they're running out of road. This is the thing.
Yeah. So what you're saying is, essentially, there's two options. Putin stays in power by way of us forgiving him.
Yeah.
Or Putin loses power and Russia implodes, which, Jesus, God knows what will happen.
That's what I think. So the Putin stays in power, not Putin, but Putin's gang.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The KGBization of Russia, because they have grabbed all the levers of power. They have everything. They own the media, they own the cops, they own everything, the courts, everything, right? So either they stay in power, and in order for them to stay in power, we have to bequeath, well, not we, the Americans have to allow that to come to pass. It's like almost like a papal in the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages, the Pope would give
anointed
you,
by the Pope.
You know, they could sell an indulgence, he'd be all right. Yeah, you know, it's a very, very Catholic view, okay, right? Okay, so imagine...
Three Hail Marys.
Imagine you're Pope Pius II, the fellow who I told you wrote the erotic poetry.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yes,
oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
did an alliance with Vlad the Impaler.
Was he fart Brett?
He wasn't fart Brett. Came after him, right?
Okay.
But he was the guy who was around when Gutenberg was doing the Bible.
Yes, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Now, so either we do that, so we say to Putin, we will give you a lifeline. And by giving you a lifeline, we have to, what are you selling us? And what Putin will say, we'll sell you is a deal to keep the Chinese at bay in Siberia.
Right.
Because the Americans do not want the Chinese getting their hands on any of Russian raw materials.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the thing. But Russia is demographically compromised up there because there's not enough Russians in that part of the world.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So that's the first thing.
Jesus, you're not talking flying in American troops there.
I'm talking about an alliance between Russia and America that has never happened before.
Yeah.
And it's between Alaska. Think of where Alaska is.
Yeah. No, but what I mean is if there is a border...
No, it wouldn't. It would be just the Americans issue. And the Russians would understand that they have a mutuality of interest.
Right, and that would be enough to keep the Chinese at bay.
That would keep
you
enough. So basically, the theatre of geopolitics moves from Western Europe to Alaska.
Yeah.
Imagine that, just in your head, right?
Sarah Palin would be great.
I can see Russia. I can see foreign countries, right? And in so doing, you hold your nose and allow the transfer of power from Putin to one of his cronies.
Yeah.
That's the stability pact idea.
Okay.
The other one is that all these various centrifugal forces that are pulling Russia apart, whether it's Crimea, whether it's Chechnya, whether it's the Caucasus, whether it's the youth rebellion, whether it's the fact that the youth want to disappear, they want to leave, you know, all these forces, they're dragging Russia apart, okay? They become irresistible. And the system implodes, and Russia has a fall of the Berlin Wall moment, Mark II.
Yeah.
And the system collapses. And of course, the European Union doesn't want that, because what that means is whole-scale migration of Russians into Europe. If Russia collapses, right? If the
system, you get a lot of brain power coming in, though.
Yeah, but you just get a lot of people, right? And then you sift out, which is, you know, but you can imagine this will be wholesale migration of Russians coming west, right? Mm. If the society implodes, right? So, and societies do implode, and particularly kleptocracies implode because they're deeply fragile. Russia is only kept in power by power itself. You know, it's not like a country says, "Oh, we've got a constitution that keeps us in power." Power is what gels Russia together.
Yeah,
and Moscow is the power, right? But if the power in Moscow, as it did in 1917. Disappears.
Yeah.
A vacuum happens, right? And into that vacuum is a vortex of chaos, and people migrate. So if you're sitting in Washington, you're thinking, okay, what are my options here?
Mm.
And one of my options is an alliance with a kleptocratic government, which is Putin's. And that explains exactly what Putin's doing now. All this saber rattling, all this causing havoc down in Ukraine. It's all to seek attention, to get to the table, to exercise his exit strategy. And that's the only way he has to cling to power. And you know that summit, John, that's going to happen. We could host it.
Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, Iceland hosted these summits in the past, Finland in the past, Norway in the past.
Yeah.
Small countries can host summits. And that would be an amazing way for us to reimagine Ireland on the global stage, to say, do you know what? We are a safe space for you. You can come here and you can actually do your business. And imagine the soft power we'd get. It'd be extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I can think of it. Ireland is neutral. We don't have any enemies, right?
Yeah.
We're on the UN Security Council.
Yeah.
Right? We have friends all over the place. I always think neutrality can be either active or passive. Passive neutrality I call sneering neutrality. It's the Irish way. And it's really easy to sit on the ditch and say, I wouldn't do that. Imagine saying, no, we're going to be neutral, but we're going to be actively neutral.
Yeah.
And we're going to host things and we're going to be part of the conversation. And that's what I think we should do. We should say, post-COVID.
Well, I was going to say they could negotiate during their mandatory quarantine.
Exactly. You could do it in City
Trump's
West.
Dune bag.
As long as you require. of the goodwill, the ladder's a planet, Roy is a star, and I am a satellite, I will be set alight. Trust you to wreck it, even when it's under your nose. Well, you just can't see it, can you? Well, it's here, right under your nose, and you just can't see it, can you?
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.